Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with C.S. Harris, also known as Candace Proctor, whose new book in her Sebastian St. Cyr series is What the Devil Knows. We'll also hear from Melissa Ginsberg about her novel, The House Uptown. It is a great pleasure to welcome C.S. Harris back to The Reading Life. C.S. Harris, we should say, is the pen name of New Orleans writer Candace Proctor. Candace has won over legions of readers for her long-running Regency mystery series featuring Sebastian St. Cyr and his wife, Hero Jarvis. And this month, she's celebrating the 16th book in the series, What the Devil Knows. Candy also has a Ph.D. in 19th century European history and has published scholarly works as well as many other popular series. Candace Proctor, C.S. Harris, Candy, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, I realized the other day you were the last author I interviewed in person before the shutdown.
Not.
You were. So how has this year been for you in writing? Has it been a struggle, an escape, all those things?
It's been hard. It really has been. I got a head start on the book that was just due this spring, and I'm glad I did because I found it very hard to focus. I think it's because, for me at least, writing comes from my subconscious, and I had so many troublesome thoughts that I was pushing down that in order to delve into that subconscious and to write a book, I had to release some things that I really didn't want to deal with. And I know I wasn't alone. I know so many author friends who were struggling, who were late on deadlines. For some people, it became an escape. Maybe it depends on the kind of book you were writing.
Yeah.
I don't know, but it was hard.
This is kind of a dark, dark book. I mean, the story takes place in 1814. And murders take place that look just like another series of murders that took place 3 years earlier in 1811. And these are based on real murders, historical murders. So set up the story for us a bit.
Well, the idea for the book came from very real murders, like murders, series of murders, the Ratcliffe Highway murders, which occurred in December of 1811. And they paralyzed London as much, if not more so, than the Jack the Ripper murders did in the Victorian age, because it was kind of killings that the city had never seen before. Two entire families were wiped out, first one and then the other, very brutally bashed, their heads bashed in, their throats slit, and that included even, you know, children and a little baby. And they were killed in their homes, which is something that just didn't happen mm-hmm. in London at that time. And they were very famous at the time, and they paralyzed London, and a man named John Williams was arrested, and before he could even have his pretrial hearing, he was found hanging in his cell, and so everything kind of went away. And so what I have happened in this book, What the Devil Knows, is that in 1814, suddenly these murders start happening, similar murders, to people who were peripherally involved with the Ratcliffe Highway investigation. These murders start happening again. So Sebastian starts questioning, okay, what really happened in 1811 with the Ratcliffe Highway murders? And this enables him to go back and kind of reinvestigate those killings. Because if you look at the history of the investigation, you start realizing that in reality and historically, these investigations were very flawed, and that the person that they suspected of having done it and who was found hanging and declared a suicide probably actually wasn't the murderer, that there was something else going on there. So this is sort of my invention of what was really going on there. And then again, at Sebastian's time in 1814.
Well, I know that you have to research every book in terms of details like that. Like, what were those murders? When did they happen? And, you know, what happened to John Williams? But for the rest of the period, do you just kind of slip into the stream of this history at will? Or is there a comfort zone there for you, knowing things, knowing the words for things?
I know the period really well, but for every book, I do have to research because there's always specific things for those particular weeks that the book is set that either I never knew or I've forgotten. And to a certain extent, I slip into it, but I will still make mistakes. You know, it's like I think at least I can only focus on so many things at once. And if I'm focusing on action and I'm focusing on what the characters are thinking, what they're saying, sometimes I will slip. And like I got a note from somebody the other day that said, "You have Sebastian leaning on a hay bale." They didn't have hay bales in 1813 or whatever it was. I was like, "No, you're right. They didn't." And I don't know why I had him leaning against a hay bale, but he was in a barn, and, you know, in my world, barns have hay bales, and so I leaned him against one, and that was my big oop.
Who'd have thunk a hay bale? I mean,
I grew up, I had a horse as a kid, you know, we had a barn, and when I was in the barn, I was leaning on hay bales, so, you know, even though I know that they didn't have hay bales in 1811, but somehow another one popped up. So,
sure enough.
Yeah, it's always sometimes I'm flowing in it, and then at other times those big oops will slip in.
Well, there are all eagle-eyed readers out there, you know.
Oh, yeah. Don't you dare put a dog breathe in there.
Yeah. So tell us about, you know, these characters that have sustained you for so, so many books, Sebastian and his wife, the wonderfully named Hero Jarvis, and they are now the parents of an infant son, Simon.
I've been living with these characters now for, this is the 16th book, but I think I started this series, the very first book in the series. I started writing it in 2003, and I lived with the characters for a couple of years, just turning them over in my head. For a couple of years before that, so it's been 20 years. These people have been a part of my life, which I never dreamt, you know, at the time that I would still be doing this. But they're fascinating characters to me. When I first started thinking about the series, a friend of mine, Laura Jo Rowland, said, "You know, think ahead."
Right.
And so I did. I planned out before I even wrote the first book, the personal story arc that Sebastian goes through, because when we first meet him, he has just returned from the war. He's very wounded psychologically and morally from the things he did and the things he saw, and he really doesn't care if he lives or dies, and he's very much in love with the woman in a star-crossed love affair, which ends very badly for him. So he has a very much a personal journey, and in a sense, the investigation of these murders becomes a kind of a way of retribution for him, to make amends for some of the things he did in the war. And that's he finds justice for the victims of murder. He begins by being accused of murder himself, which is kind of how he gets in.
Right.
There is a very involved personal story arc with his family and his parentage, which has certain questions that hang over it, and then his eventual very deep love affair with his wife, Hero, who becomes an increasingly important person, character in the series.
I love her. You know I love her. She's one of my favorite characters.
She's kind of like the woman I would like to be. She's
yes.
Tall, whereas I'm very short.
I know, the tall quality. I can see that. It's like the fairy godmother gives her character what she wants.
Yes, and she's very brave, and she's very in your face and very confident, all those things that I would like to be, but you know, will never be, especially the tall part.
Right. A little late for that. So. So when Laura Jo Rowland told you to plan ahead, how far ahead do you plan? Where are you in the actual writing of the series now?
Well, you know, it's funny because when she said that, I thought I planned this personal story arc, and I thought I would cover it in maybe 6 or 8 books. So I still haven't finished what I thought was going to be the personal. A big part of it I will do in the book that comes out next year, which is When Blood Lies. That everybody's been wanting to know about Sebastian's mother and his father, and so that's coming up. But even that's not completely answered. So at one point I had thought, maybe I'll end this series, with Waterloo. But now I'm thinking, no, I haven't answered all of these questions. And of course, as I went along, I came up with, that would make a good wrinkle and complication. So I've sort of extended things out a bit. So I'm trying to wrap up some of these dangling ends, but I seem to keep creating new ones as I go along, because for me, they really are almost very real.
I think it would be terrible for you to let them go, you know?
I don't think I could at this point. After 20 years, how could I just say, that's it? So I'm glad that the series is doing well enough that I can keep writing them, because I would really hate to. I'm not sure that I will ever quit. I'm just, they'll literally take the pen out of my cold desk.
Now, talk about this for me. You recently received the Diana Pinkley Prize for Distinguished Body of Work in Crime Fiction. Talk a little bit about what that meant to you. I mean, did that make you kind of stop and look and go, whoa, look at what I did?
It was a huge shock. It was, I really did not expect it. And it was, I'm still kind of processing it. I was very humbled and very flattered. At the same time, it was like, really, me? You gave that to me? I think that writers probably fall into two categories. There's the ones who think that everything that they write is wonderful, and then there's the ones like me who think they have this imposter syndrome, that they think, they're going to be discovered at any moment, that they really don't know what they're doing. And so it was a great honor, and I'm still kind of in a state of shock about it. There's so many wonderful writers, very, very famous, successful writers, have won it in the past, that it really is a great honor to see my name up there with them.
Well, 16 books in, that's a body of work. It's been so much fun to read your books all along the way. I feel very lucky.
Thank you.
All right. We've been talking with C.S. Harris, also known as Candace Proctor, the author of What the Devil Knows. Candy, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Melissa Ginsberg was born and raised in Houston, Texas, and attended the Iowa Writers' Workshop. She's the author of the poetry collection Dear Weather Ghost and two chapbooks, Arbor and Double Blind. Her first novel was Sunset City, and today we're talking with her about her brand new second novel set here in New Orleans called The House Uptown. Melissa teaches literature and creative writing at the University of Mississippi, and we're speaking to her from her home in Oxford. Melissa, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan.
So set up the storyline for us a bit. How does this young girl named Ava come to be so alone in the world, striking out from Iowa to New Orleans to make a new life?
Yeah, so Ava comes to New Orleans to stay with her grandmother after the sudden death of her mother. So she is orphaned, having grown up in Iowa City, and she just gets on a train and heads down to New Orleans to meet Lane, this grandmother who she doesn't even remember. And Lane lives in this house uptown around the corner from Audubon Park. So that's where Ava ends up.
Now, there's a lot of love and understanding of New Orleans in this book. So talk about how you came by that.
Yeah, well, all of my family is from Louisiana, and my mother grew up in New Orleans, and I've still got a lot of family in New Orleans, and actually my parents moved back and they live uptown again. I grew up in Houston, but I grew up raised by a New Orleanian and going back and forth on I-10 just all the time. That was my childhood of just going to New Orleans all the time and seeing my cousins and staying at my grand's house. I never have lived there, but it is a city that I know and love and was a very magical place to me as a child, and it just still is.
Now, one of the things I really admire about this book is the way it captures our obsessions with the past. And the house itself is a real character there. So talk about creating that house. That must have been just a dreamy experience for you.
Yeah. I mean, I love houses. I always have. And the house in the book is based on my grand's house on Coliseum Street, which hasn't been in my family for many years, but it is the place where my mother grew up. It was beautiful to me and magical and also dark and had like a sense of history to it. You know, growing up in Houston, most of the architecture is fairly new. And so I was fascinated by the old wavy glass windows in my grand's house and the high ceilings and the sense of gravity that was there in that place.
Talk about the room that Ava gravitates to herself.
Yeah, so this used to be my mom's old bedroom. It's the sun porch. It's like an enclosed porch over a carport. So it's got windows on three sides. And in the novel, Lane, the grandmother, has just used it to store Mardi Gras costumes. And so there's decades and decades worth of costumes just shoved in there. And there's a little cot in the middle of it. And this is where Ava sleeps the first night that she is in the house. And she feels surrounded by all of this fabric and crazy wigs and boas and thinks about her mother having worn some of those costumes as a child.
Well, you can tell you have experience with the New Orleans house with a costume closet. Really?
Yeah.
We all have one of those. So talk about these three people who interact in this house and how they are so alone in the world. And some of them like it that way and some of them hope for connection. And it's interesting to see what happens when they come together.
So Lane is an artist. She's a painter, a commercial artist. She paints murals for restaurants and hotels, and she's very sought after. She has her work featured in fancy home decor magazines, and she gets a lot of public attention, and she is really not interested in that at all. She only wants to focus on her work. She's kind of a visionary-driven artist, and she really has arranged her life to only focus on that. So she has hired an assistant, Oliver, who's another important character in the book, to take care of all the mundane tasks in her life so that she does not have to be distracted from her paintings. So he gets groceries, keeps plenty of wine in the house, pays her bills, all of that. And he also loves Lane, admires her, and really, she's not an easy person to get along with. She's a little grouchy. She's a little prickly. And Oliver pushes back against that. He's got a really strong personality himself, which is why he's been able to put up with her and do that work for so long. And then Ava enters into this situation, and her presence disrupts the equilibrium that they had going and brings up a lot of feelings in Lane, and she's not real stable. She's been dealing with some memory loss, which she's afraid to get checked out. And her granddaughter, Ava, looks a lot like her daughter, Louise, who she was estranged from and who has recently died. And so they're all dealing with quite a lot of loss and grief, and each other's presence, you know, brings all of that to the surface.
Now, this novel is so many things. It's a crime novel, and you flirted with that form in your previous novel, Sunset City, and it's a literary novel as well as a coming-of-age story. So you really packed a lot of information and style in here.
Thank you. I mean, I love crime novels, and I certainly allow those tropes in to sort of shape and direct these stories. But I'm mostly interested in the characters. I'm interested in these people. And yeah, I think this is a book that is bigger than any one genre. It doesn't fit too comfortably in any one genre, but it's certainly character driven, and it has, I have training background as a poet, and one of the primary skills of poets is compression. And so I think that my tendency to get all of this stuff in a pretty short book is coming out of working in a much more greatly compressed poetry.
But beautiful descriptions, too, I have to say. So many unforgettable descriptions. And I love the way you put Ava, just the right age to have just enough independence and take off on her bike and learn the city that way.
Yeah, Ava is 14, and she comes from a place, Iowa City, that is laid out on a north-south grid. In fact, the entire state of Iowa is just all right angles. Every road in there. And so she comes to New Orleans and doesn't understand the culture or the landscape or the layout of the street, but she has nothing to do and she doesn't know anyone. So I gave her a bike. I mean, Oliver gives her a bike, but I wanted her to be able to move around and explore and watch things. And I love seeing the city through Ava's eyes, because I am also an outsider who is, even though I have this more intimate relationship with New Orleans, I will never know it like somebody who grew up there. So I wanted to get all of Ava's impressions as an outsider from a place that is really foreign to New Orleans.
And I love that she is both sweet and very tough at the same time.
Yeah, this book, Louise, Ava's mother, who's passed away before the book begins, and Lane and Ava, these are three generations of very strong women who are quite different from one another, who often had a lot of clashes, but each one of them is stubborn and strong and sure of herself and makes her way in life regardless of what direction she's being pushed in. So I loved exploring those relationships.
Well, this is a book that keeps you turning pages. No matter how much you think you know about New Orleans, you see something new. And it was delightful to read this and see the city through her eyes, Lane's eyes, your eyes.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking with the poet and novelist Melissa Ginsberg, whose new book is The House Uptown. Melissa, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. This was lovely to talk to you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The Jefferson Parish East Bank Regional Library presents four local poets, Gina Ferrara, Jonathan Klein, Ralph Adamo, and Karen Massera, who will discuss poetry in their latest works at 6 p.m. Monday, April 12th, via video conference online hosted by Chris Smith. Visit jplibrary.net/adults for more details, including how to join in the discussion. Melissa Ginsberg discusses her novel, The House Uptown, with Laura Lippman in a Zoom conversation, Tuesday, April 13th at 6. Free, but tickets required. Tickets at GardenDistrictBookshop.com. One Book, One New Orleans hosts a discussion of the second movement of The Yellow House, a memoir by Sarah Broom, Thursday, April 15th at 6:30. Register for Zoom link at onebookonenola.org. Kelly Harris DeBerry will be the guest at Virtual Happy Hour Friday, April 16th at 5, sponsored by Garden District Bookshop. The New Orleans Writers Workshop has three upcoming classes. Allison Alsup teaches Writing the Very, Very Short Story, beginning April 19th. Jessica Kinnison teaches The Mystery of Suffering, How to Write What Hurts, starting April 28th. And Brad Richard teaches How to Write a Poem, beginning May 1st. Go to neworleanswriters.com to register. The New Orleans Poetry Festival continues throughout the month of April. Check out nolapoetry.com for complete schedule. And finally, we mourn the passage of Lee Crew, who died Saturday, April 3rd, at her home in New Orleans. Lee was the author of the poetry collections French Quarter Poems, Downtown, and Trains and Other Intrusions, a chapbook of poetry. She also wrote Blood at the Root, a novel, and Goodbye Silver, Silver Cloud, a collection of short stories. And she co-edited Mending for Memory, Sewing in Louisiana, Essays, Stories, and Poems with Susan Tucker. Lee hosted the New Orleans Poetry Forum from 1976 to 1990, invited poets to the Backyard Poetry Theater at her house, which became the Front Room Poetry Space. She also edited the New Laurel Review. The New Orleans Poetry Festival will hold a tribute reading to Lee April 18th at 5, with poets Gina Ferrara, Peter Cooley, Julie Kane, and Valentine Pierce. Join on Zoom or watch on Facebook. Check out nolapoetry.com for details. Funding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.